One, two, three, four.
It's a complicated time to think about how we can slow down and be still and bring a brilliant group of people together to do something that feels like it has purpose and can be productive. And when I was bringing up that idea of a Hinge generation, I think it's impossible to even know how we will look back and reflect on this time and these moments. So we are very invested in enabling people to build new relationships. And actually what we found from these past gatherings in Aspen is that those are the things that people still talk about from 40, 50, 60 years ago. And you were also asking about a relationship with the environment. I think Maya Lin, who's coming to give a keynote lecture, is someone who is very invested in that conversation. We also are working with the Serpentine Gallery and Hans-Ulrich Obrist on the keynote lectures. Francis Kerr is also coming to talk about the sustainability of his architectural practice and how that really navigates the world differently. We're also working with Storefront for Architecture. This year, there is a focus really on the relationship between the question that we have posed for the retreat, which is really this idea of our relationship with technology and identifying our relationship with the world and how we want to be present at the moment. For us, I think it really is about trust and commitment and how we can engage an audience, spark the curiosity that people are looking for. But I think the most important thing often is how we can spark that curiosity in ourselves and as a kind of way of working, which I think is the most important framework as an institution, that the institution is also wanting to learn and evolve constantly and isn't a static place, particularly coming from an opportunity of not being a collecting institution as well, that we are sort of ever evolving, ever changing.
Today, we're joined by Nicola Lees, who is truly pushing the boundaries of what a museum can be. Since 2020, she has been director of the Aspen Art Museum, a non-collecting, artist-founded institution dedicated to experimentation and supporting the most innovative voices in contemporary art. Under her direction, the Aspen Art Museum has just unveiled an ambitious decade-long initiative called Air Aspen. Running from July 26th to August 1st, AIR isn't just another program. It is the first artist-led global summit, a bold undertaking that will bring together artists, cultural leaders, policymakers, and influencers for yearly talks and performances, workshops, and an annual retreat. It's designed to explore the profound role of art in addressing the big questions of our time, from AI to how we relate to one. The inaugural theme, Life as No One Knows It, promises to be a deeply engaging exploration of what it means to be alive in an era of rapid technological and environmental change. And it will feature an extraordinary roster of creatives whose work transcends traditional disciplines, including Francis Carré, Paul Chan, Aria Dean, Glenn Ligon, and Maya Lin. Before her tenure in Aspen, Nicola Lees made her mark as the director and curator of New York University's ADWSE and as a curator for Frieze projects at Frieze London. Today, we'll delve into her philosophy of art, leadership, and the transformative power of this new initiative. Nicola Lees, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now you've been at the Aspen Art Museum through a period of real transformation since 2020. I mean, what a year to come to a museum when we're all thinking about what a museum is. What has guided your vision during this time, and how do you define the role of the museum in our moment?
Aspen is a very remote location. I think it was an interesting experience for me coming here, especially from living and working in London and New York City. I think there is also an interesting moment where a non-collecting museum is also able to think slightly differently. We've had an opportunity to really shift the atmosphere in the building over the last 5 years, really come together and think about where we want to invest in the future of the museum and also in the legacy of art and the avant-garde in Aspen. So I very much had a strong vision for the museum when I was interviewing for the role, which isn't something that always happens. It really is my first role as a museum director. So I think often there are advantages and disadvantages to the things you know and don't know. The one thing we have really wanted to maintain and hold on to and really have at the core of everything we're doing is thinking about how the museum was actually founded by artists. And I think that even though now we're in an incredible Shugiru Ban building for the last decade, that legacy of being an artist-founded institution is something that we have maintained almost on a daily basis. In terms of the vision for the museum, I think it is something that's kind of happened almost immediately in 2020. We worked with a lot of artists on long-term projects. We worked with Precious Okoimon on a rooftop garden over 2.5 years. Jonathan Berger, who's an incredible American artist, reinvented our museum store. And we were able to really create different stories and narratives with how we engaged with the local public. We just deinstalled a youth art expo where we had 1,700 kids from the Valley exhibiting their own artworks in the museum in the same galleries that we've shown Warhol. And I think it is a moment of really being able to think about us being sometimes the first museum that people will step into, as well as having a very sophisticated audience. I think that it is something that we're always learning and growing. And so we're also wanting to collaborate in different ways and think differently about how we're approaching conversations, especially with our partner institutions.
Yes, and what a wonderful experience to give those young people who might not yet consider themselves artists to say, we believe that your work belongs in a space that has shown Warhols and others. And I know myself as an artist, just having someone believe in you at that early stage is so important. And so you talk about being uniquely artist-founded and a non-collecting space. So what does it mean to lead a museum that prioritizes ideas and connections over collecting?
I think it really is about relationships. And that is something that's been very prominent throughout my career. And how the relationships work with, as we've just talked about, we have just finished this incredible youth art expo where we've shown 1,700 works by children and youth in the Valley. And this is really looking at a great example at Moderna Musette, where they had an incredible exhibition called The Model for a Qualitative Society, which was curated actually by an artist who ran their education department called Paul Nielsen. And so this was very much when the youth in Stockholm were able to take over the museum in quite a radical way. And so we've been thinking a lot about how artists have really also been able to reimagine the institution. When we think about that, this is really, again, going back to how we harness the institution being an artist-founded organization and how we work with artists. I think it's very important for us that the museum adapts to those relationships. I think it's very important that the artists are able to sort of leave an imprint on the museum. And so when we're working, we are thinking through about how those relationships grow over time, how we can nurture creative thinking. And also in many ways, as we've often been saying recently, also really wanting to nurture our subconsciouses as well. So really wanting to think through about how we construct new ways of working and how we can often rethink kind of the rules to the game.
Indeed. Now, Air Aspen, which is this new inaugural first artist-led global summit of its kind, what question or cultural necessity gave rise to it? How do you place it within the other global summits?
I think that it really goes back to what a museum can be at this time. And it's not the easiest question to be asking ourselves. And also, Aspen, there is an incredible history of artists being in Aspen since 1945 to the present day. There's been some really rather incredible and radical reasons for that. And one historical example is the International Design Conference that happened in Aspen from 1945 to 2004. And in many ways, the Aspen Art Museum came out of these gatherings. It came out of the Goethe Bicentennial that was really the birth of the Aspen Institute. It came out of the International Design Conference. The artists that founded the museum would have been meeting a lot of the incredible minds that were coming to those events. The International Design Conference was sometimes the first time artists and thinkers came to America. We did a big project with Gaetano Pesce in 2022, where we actually commissioned one of his last works for the facade of the building at the museum. And he came to the International Design Conference, I think, in 1973. And that was really before he moved to New York City and showed at MoMA. And we have been researching the archives at the International Design Conference. There were also incredible moments where we have been up on Susan Sontag's time in Aspen as well as particularly the 1983 International Design Conference, where very young Mylin came and met Steve Jobs in 1983, and really thinking about the relationships that were forged through that sort of spirit. I mean, there's a very much a mind-body-spirit in Aspen. Thinking through about what it means to think differently at high altitude as well as in nature. And Aspen is not easy to get to, so often people have to make a commitment to being here. It's often a place where it makes sense to come for a number of days. And so we've been thinking a lot about what it means for the museum to have grown out of that idea of gathering in the mountains and how we can connect back to that history of artists spending time in Colorado and how those conversations, how the investment in research, thought leadership, and artists as leaders can really also potentially have a kind of ripple effect both nationally and internationally.
What role do you feel that artists have as leaders, and how does that differ from leadership that we see in politics or say with summits like Davos or business leaders or even academia? What do you think of that unique role that artists have to help us, we talk about design, a better future, a better tomorrow that we can all appreciate?
I think that is very important question to use that term in the present moment. We've been working with Charlotte Burns and interviewing a lot of artists and trying to have a moment to reflect on conversations around what artist leadership looks and feels like. And also been thinking about building their own organizations and institutions, forging new ways for us to think about the future. And also there's a huge amount of history of artists being involved in pedagogical structures, really wanting to change the way we think and see the world. We're working with Paul Chan, who is an incredible artist. He's very involved with AIR, and he's part of the Artist Leadership Program. Paul is someone who has also lived many different lives. I mean, he also gave up making art for a decade, but he is also now really thinking about his relationship with AI and his own development of Paul Prime, which is an AI portrait of himself. So I think how we want to connect with that term, I think, always changes as all conversations around leadership change at different moments. And how we can invest in something that is unknown and maybe a little less defined. But it is something that is incredibly important and also just feels like a natural and obvious conversation for me to have. And it's been interesting that other people have been so surprised by even us thinking about those terms.
Yeah, well, I've certainly seen that artists can be powerful catalysts for change just because they're also open and maybe not be specialists. And I know that the Aspen Art Museum also has notable environmental pledges. I think that it's interesting. We're finding, you know, even artists moving into that space of telling immersive long-form storytelling, that it can be a little bit more open and multidisciplinary, which I know is very important for you. And just going back to when you came to the Aspen Art Museum in 2020, that was the pandemic. Difficult time for museums. How can we host exhibitions? I mean, for us personally as a podcast, we went from doing exhibitions to bringing the conversations we were showing in universities and spaces to podcasts because that was the only way to reach people. And it's nice that it's worked out, but it made us all rethink. Now, do you think that we have really absorbed those lessons we learned from the pandemic? Because for a lot of people, they started appreciating art more, even if they couldn't visit the museums, but they started appreciating the arts and what they can do and enjoying music and film and within the privacy of their own home, and made all these kind of commitments about what they thought society could be, you know, after we stopped the social distancing. Do you think we've really learned those lessons, and how have museums really absorbed what we learned during that time?
I mean, in many ways, though, a lot of it is about how we want to make certain commitments to the ways that we're working. A lot of the work that we've been doing is wanting to also work with artists in unusual ways. And that is also something that requires a lot of trust in what we're doing. And also thinking through how we can think differently and open ourselves up to the unknown, and also be able to, as an institution, think about how we can take risks and think through how we can, maybe to our advantage because we're a little bit off the beaten track, do something that is outside of the conventional norms of what a museum should be or how it can be. Last summer, we had an incredible full building exhibition by Alison Katz. We really wanted to dedicate a moment to painting in the whole building, and Alison Katz curated a painting exhibition in the whole building, and we were also able to bring these incredible fragments from Pompeii, where she had been in residence for the year before. And in many ways, it was almost an opportunity for us to collapse time in terms of conversations around painting. We were thinking about how the museum became a Pompeian villa where we were exhibiting the artworks within the museum. It was really an opportunity for us to open up to a lot of different conversations around not only the history of painting, but also psychoanalytical conversations around particularly Freud's obsession with Pompeii, as well as working with a living artist where we could really make a huge commitment and take a leap of trust. And for us, I think it really is about trust and commitment. And I don't think that's necessarily changed over the years. And then as we're working on that, you know, obviously we're very much invested in how we can engage an audience, spark the curiosity that people are looking for. But I think the most important thing often is how we can spark that curiosity in ourselves and as a kind of way of working, which I think is the most important framework as an institution, that the institution is also wanting to learn and evolve constantly and isn't a static place. And I think that's also particularly coming from an opportunity of not being a collecting institution as well, that we are sort of ever evolving, ever changing.
Yeah, exactly. And that germ of curiosity and the unknown, I think that that ties into your theme for this inaugural year at AIR, Life as No One Knows It. What was the thinking behind that? And just tell us a little bit about the different artists and also, we should say, multidisciplinary voices that are taking part.
We have been pilot programming over the last few years, but with this year, we're delighted that Sara Imran Walker has allowed us to use the title of her new novel, Life as No One Knows It. And this is really something that is going to become a theme that will work across both a 3-day retreat for about 30 to 40 brilliant minds and also a 3-day public festival that will take place at the end of July in Aspen across multiple venues around the city and also in the landscape. Sara's book is really thinking about how we define life or how we can radically challenge our definitions of life forms. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been working with a core group of artists, which include Paul Chan, who has since 2018 been making an AI portrait of himself called Paul Prime, and also Zoe Hitzig, who's a brilliant economist and poet, and also has recently been working at OpenAI and really thinking about the future of our relationship with technology. The 3-day retreat is really going to be an opportunity to have brilliant minds come together, ask a specific question, and at the end of the 3 days, we'll also be working towards producing a white paper, as well as investing in more research around that topic for the future. And then the 3-day public festival is in many ways a response to those conversations, but also an opportunity to open it up to more of an immersive relationship with the performances and commissions that we are working on, particularly a large-scale commission with Matthew Barney, which is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime incredible performance.
Yeah, the questions around AI, which is just growing so fast, not to mention that, but just digital and VR and the whole technology is just rapidly reshaping, and particularly the last 2 years has been reshaping, as you know, the way some artists are working, the general public, how we communicate with ourselves, our imaginations. What do you imagine for the Museum of the Future? Is it becoming now like this, we talk about immersive exhibitions, a hybrid space, part physical, part digital, festival, summit? How do you see technology and particularly AI changing not just the work of artists, but the shape, the forms of museums?
I think with the retreat, we are thinking about one very specific question, which is in some shape or form in not too distant future, we're all going to need potentially new identity documents where we're going to have personhood credentials where we can identify that we are human and who we are as we're interacting with each other in different ways and in different platforms. So we're really engaged in a discussion around how artists can also be part of the conversation conversation about what that could be and really thinking about where we are and how we're interacting with each other. These are huge topics and we're only really focusing in on one very specific conversation. We also have someone incredible called Jameson Webster, who's a brilliant psychoanalyst, coming. And she maybe in passing mentioned that after doing a quite brilliant lecture on the subconscious and psychoanalysis, she was asked a question about our relationships with technology and the screen and how most of the things that we scroll on our phones don't actually enter into our subconscious. This has been proven with memory tests when you're reading off a screen and how much you retain in terms of your memory versus a physical publication. So we are also very much thinking about our relationship with our subconscious and how museums are a place for that to be very much a space for thinking differently. I'm sure there'll be many institutions that are going to become more hybrid. In Aspen, we are very much a place where people potentially may be able to slow down a bit. You're in nature. It's a location where the history of gathering has been so important. So I think for us, we're really wanting to harness at the moment what we can achieve by building relationships in person in a remote location and talking about advancements in technology. We have some brilliant minds coming, including John Nanier, who was one of the founders of virtual reality.
He's been on our show. He's great. Yeah. His memoir is brilliant too. He's a great polymath and advocates for don't have social media. You know, it's kind of a contradiction. I thought it was funny because we have a podcast called AI and the Future of Humanity. And we've been talking about these things since before the rollout of general AI. Nick Bostrom, who was talking about superintelligence from way back and founded the Oxford Future of Humanity Institute. Mm-hmm. We had interviewed him and I was thinking about having him back on the show. But of course, now the Oxford Future of Humanity Institute is closed. So we discussed all the AI. And they were warning for ages and he was big on that bandwagon for a long time, even influencing Elon Musk. And then it's closed. They said they no longer needed it. So we've come beyond the point that was predicted. And I don't mean to be humorous about it. I just think it's funny of going back even just a few years ago, the conversations we had of what was possible. And then we've moved beyond that. So it's really hard. And I think that it's interesting in the space of a museum, a traditional institutional space, there can be a place for also speculating on futures and bringing people together. And I like that it's analog. And then, of course, within Aspen, you have the tangible world, the natural world. This is a great space to talk about the future, but also, as you say, going back to Pompeii and reflecting on the past. So it's kind of like a place where the past and present can meet. Can you tell us a little bit more about your environmental commitments, the questions around nature and sustainability and biodiversity and how that enters into your summit and into your planned exhibitions?
Yeah, the world is changing very fast. And when we have been thinking a lot about the question around artist leadership or just leadership in general, there have been moments when this term of a hinged generation is also coming up,
right?
Because everything is going to develop and change so fast. I was someone who had my first email address at 18 or something like that. So this kind of 89 plus conversation was the last time we had a hinged generation. And so I think that that is something where we are focused on another question this summer, which is really like, what does it mean to be human in a moment of this radical technological transformation? And I think that's where the conversations around life as no one knows it and Sarah Imran Walker's book about the definitions of life and intelligence and wanting to have a conversation around that framework is also an opportunity for us to think through our relationship with ourselves as well as these advancements in technology. It's a complicated time to think about how we can slow down and be still and bring a brilliant group of people together to do something that feels like it has purpose and can be productive. And when I was bringing up that idea of a hinged generation, I think it's impossible to even know how we will look back and reflect on this time and these moments. So we are very invested in enabling people to build new relationships. And actually what we found from these past gatherings in Aspen is that those are the things that people still talk about from 40, 50, 60 years ago. And you were also asking about a relationship with the environment. I think Maya Lin, who's coming to give a keynote lecture, is someone who is very invested in that conversation. Someone who is a brilliant artist, architect, but also someone who can really think through complicated scientific data and predictions of the future, while also being able to harness this very sort of poetic, philosophical side. And it will be her first trip back to Aspen since 1983. And so that is something that we are thinking about. We also are working with the Serpentine Gallery in Hans-Ulrich Oberst on the keynote lectures. Francis Kerr is also coming to talk about the sustainability of his architectural practice and how that navigates the world differently. We're also working with Storefront for Architecture, who have done this brilliant swamp project the last 2 years. This year, there is a focus really on the relationship between the question that we have posed for the retreat, which is really this idea of our relationship with technology and identifying our relationship with the world and how we want to be present at the moment.
Yeah, that is one of the essential questions. And you mentioned there the Serpentine and Hans Ulbricht. He's come on our show too. And I know that you worked at the Serpentine, and also we should say Fries Projects, your curator there. And Hans Ulrich has done great work for also discussing these important issues of our time and really questioning what is the role of the artist? What is the role of institutions? So I'm curious to know what you learned from your time there in London and at the Serpentine, how that expanded your views of what an institution could do.
I think that the Serpentine is something that I reflect on often. I was there between 2008 and 2012. I'd come from the Irish Museum of Modern Art, where I'd been working on publications and exhibitions. I think that the core framework and thinking and the real joy of also focusing even more on a kind of discursive space and an interdisciplinary space is that it really opens up the possibilities of collaboration and also collaborating in unusual ways. And so that is something that we've really wanted to think through and harness with Aspen and the museum.
So museum spaces have traditionally, historically been seen as neutral spaces. When you talk about these important issues of our times, be it technology, climate crisis, you know, mass displacement, crisis of democracy, political upheaval, how can neutrality really be the role of museums now? Or can you become more political? And now, of course, under the Trump presidency, does that affect your funding? Or how involved do you like to be? How do you see yourself as an activist?
We're at a time when artists and curators and museum directors are called upon to do more than one thing in response to our times. But I find it can take a lot to embrace art for art's sake and art as a catalyst for social change at the same time. I mean, from where I'm coming from, I'm an old school oil painter.
Are you really? What kind of paintings do you make?
I do figurative and environmental and now sound art.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I worked for Bill Furlong when I was really, really young, and he did audio arts. Do you remember audio arts?
Yeah.
And they were these cassettes that you could get. And wow. He would always interview artists. And when he interviewed an artist, they could only talk about the present moment. They couldn't talk about the past or the future.
That's a different.
And he has this very, like, BBC old school 1960s, 1970s sound art. They were amazing documents. He interviewed like Joseph Beuys on the steps of Anthony Doffey Gallery as soon as he finished the install there. And I did remember helping edit things for him when I was really young.
I must revisit that. I really think, I mean, for us, I never thought of myself as a sound artist, but when we do exhibitions and I do my own personal exhibitions with the creative process, soundscapes has become part of it because there's no more space on the walls to put all the interviews. No, but it's interesting because you can bring together people, whether they're artists or neuroscientists. I see you have Anna Seth. He's come on, you know, and they come together and it becomes music. You got Max Richter adding his music, and it's interesting.
One of the most amazing shows I worked on, when I was very young, I was at the Irish Museum of Modern Art, and we did an incredible exhibition on Morton Feldman. And it was Morton Feldman's collection, actually, and he'd recently passed away, and his widow was very generous. We worked with Juan Manuel Bonet on that exhibition, who was the director of the Reina Sofía at the time, and it was so incredible to be inside the mind of a composer who was so close to living artists. And so I think, for me, like, I have these very early experiences as well of these brilliant minds who had worked in a very interdisciplinary way. We also did an incredible group show with Philippe Perrenot, which was actually before I went to the Serpentine and met with Hans Ulrich. And so really thinking through about how an artist curates a show, how an artist puts an exhibition together, how an artist thinks differently, again, across disciplines and time. And I think the attraction to that for me is really about being able to not only think differently, but as Hans Ulrich often says, people who've changed the rules of the game. But I think artists often, I remember Philippe sort of defying protocol and really wanting to be able to advance the institution. And sometimes those things are small gestures and sometimes they're big radical gestures. But it really was very informative for me early on to help me see how an artist can think differently, be in a space where I could witness clear commitment to a vision and path that needed to be constructed and followed through in a very dynamic way. We were just talking about sound and how Philippe has brought sound into exhibitions, how he's curated exhibitions like Dancing Around Duchamp, which was probably one of the most influential exhibitions I've certainly seen in my lifetime. And so really thinking about how I can continue to make a commitment to working with artists on extraordinary projects and in extraordinary ways. Yeah, I haven't thought about that show for a long time, but yeah.
Yes, I know. It's interesting because I know Emma well, and you probably know Christine Kennedy because I'm part Irish. So I'm actually going back there.
Oh, you are?
Next month. Yeah.
No way.
Yes. Yeah, so I came up in Dublin and around. Ireland's an interesting country, I think, because storytelling, the written word was always, and the oral tradition is very strong there.
Yeah. And I studied, interestingly, with Sarat Maharaj. I was a goldsmith and I was also an artist, actually. So I'm not an art historian. I think that's definitely where I locate myself. And Sarat Maharaj taught us a course that was actually, we did a year-long course on Richard Hamilton. So we studied his translation of The Large Glass, but also Ulysses. He illustrated Ulysses. And so very much my entry point almost to that history was through that class with Sarat Maharaj, where I sat next to Nairi Bagramian, who is an artist who I've become very close to and is a brilliant mind of her generation. But when I got to Dublin, I think that was something that was so profoundly important. And when I was at the museum, Enrique Yoncosa, who's actually really a poet in many ways, was the director of the museum. And so we really got to work on some incredible exhibitions. We also did an incredible exhibition called Cutups and Cutouts with William Burroughs and Hans Christian Andersen. And we're able to really think about how writing and that history of language in Ireland can cross over with the visual arts in a really unique and dynamic. I was just in Alex Katz's studio in New York. I was remembering that that was the first time I ever went to New York, was to go to Alex Katz's studio. I was very young. It was exactly the same as it had been 20 years prior. I sat on the sofa and I sat next to someone and introduced myself and said hello. And it was John Ashbery. And I just couldn't believe that I was sitting next to someone who was probably at that time the greatest living poet. And I think that those small experiences really changed my life, changed my relationship to painting as well. I think Alex changed my relationship to painting, having gone to art school in the late 90s, where everything was very much framed within a conceptual conversation. And it was magical to go back and revisit Alex in his studio 20 years later.
Those are amazing experiences. And I think that that suits your work at Aspen so well. And just on the point of Ulysses, I helped launch the James Joyce Museum. I know the Joyce family. And so that was my formative experience in Dublin, helping with that. Yeah. And it's so often, because I was discussing Renaissance art the other day, and we were talking about how it comes up from story. I mean, people don't think about that so much, but the stories inform, like, the philosophy of the Renaissance, but that it's kind of rooted in story.
It's so interesting because that also very much was like the conversations around Pompeii and how a lot of the paintings were illustrations of stories that they would tell over dinner and often tell the same stories. And I love that idea of these stories being told in different ways. I was also remembering at the Serpentine, there was a brilliant exhibition, actually just as I was making the transition in 2006. By Paul Chan. And how, again, a lot of these artists I come back to, and now I'm so privileged to be working so closely with Paul. But he, at that time, turned what was the education space that had very similar proportions and aesthetic to the galleries, because it is a repurposed building. And he did a brilliant project called Local Ops, which had one microphone that could record. And it was a field microphone that you would use to record wildlife, but an opportunity for local artists and organizations to take over that space for 24, 48 hours and do their own programs and projects in there. And it was something that also changed the way I thought about how an artist was able to completely change the dynamics of an institution with the ecosystem and the art world around it. Some people came in and staged exhibitions. Others came and did mini conversations. It's probably pre-podcast era. So a lot of it was taken over by self-organized groups. which I also think is really fascinating, how collectives are formed. And so for us, taking something like that project that Paul brought into the Serpentine for the duration of his exhibition and really thinking about it as a philosophy for the institution itself, and how we can invest in artists, research, the creative process, which is the name of your podcast, and how, I mean, we have a very clear vision for the museum, and it does relatively, like all institutions run like a well-oiled machine, but I think it is about how we can maintain that space of unknowing, which is so important to creativity. And it was probably also at the time a big risk for the Serpentine to do something that was so open.
My name is Jamie Lammers. A lot of what Nicola talked about in this interview really resonated with me personally. For one, the art museum is in my home state of Colorado. And for two, as Nicola talked about, the art museum is located in a very remote community and is very artist-centered. As a no-collection museum, it collaborates a lot with different artists. This is something that really stuck out to me as someone who has grown up in a small mountain community for his entire life and writes for a local paper to promote local musicians. I think that emphasizing local art and art created in certain areas is incredibly important, but I also think it's incredibly important for museums like the Aspen Art Museum to bring in artists from all around the world to a remote location and collaborate with a museum that allows them to show their work in the way they most want. I think focusing on an artist-centered mentality for the museum allows artists to really show their true colors, and collaborating with the artists directly doesn't enforce any particular rules when it comes to what the artists can do. Now more than ever, it's incredibly important to highlight art and give spaces for it, especially in more remote communities and smaller towns. More than ever, art resonates with people emotionally, politically, and even, to a certain extent, physically. And it's incredibly important to keep the arts alive so we can communicate through our creativity. Paraphrasing a quote from Dead Poets Society, science allows us to live. Art allows us to thrive. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, and I like this invitation to bring others in and have them imagine the space, because they become co-creators. It's a kind of partnership. And any work of art is co-created with the one who is viewing it, because it's interpretive. And it can't exist without existing in the mind of the artist, but also the viewer, or however it is received. And I also strongly believe in this. It's something, a little kind of side project of ours, is I call it the invisible arts. But you talked about programs and bringing young people or educational initiatives. I think like teachers behind the scenes, and they can be curators, they can be editors. There's so many, I call them the invisible arts, because we don't think of them. They're not the big marquee artists. Or they could be within an artist practice, they can be the fabricators. There's a lot of invisible hands at work that we don't hear about. I mean, even cinematographers who do so much, you barely hear a shout out about the cinematographers who do so much in the service of the director, but our artists in their own right. So I think it's very important, all these things, giving a space for the established artists whose names we know, but also these invisible pieces of society who do so much valuable work, and it's low paid as it is with teachers or even like parents. They do so much to support those who go on to have their names celebrated.
Yeah, I think it's a really brilliant question. And it is interesting about how one can think about how that really needs to be at the core of what we're doing, and how we're thinking about how an institution can grow and how institutions need to change over the next 5 to 10 or 20 years. And it's complicated, but it's a really brilliant question. We did a great show when I was at NYU with Jason Harata, which was really about exactly what you've been talking about. I think the other thing that's so fascinating is actually when you see artists, even how they collaborate and work with each other and edit each other's work or support each other. We've been thinking about with AIR, we're also really imagining it as a support structure as well. You know, it very much will have this public moment where it will feel like a festival, but it really is part of the institution, and thinking about how artists work together. I was talking to Charlotte Burns recently about how with Anonymous as a Woman and all of the other reports that she's been working on, one of the main questions when they were asking artists audience about what they need, often what's come back is community. And I think that is something that we need to think through, how an institution can support that creative process as well, of how everyone is working together on something. And it can also sit outside of the dominant narratives of this idea of a single artist in the studio.
Indeed. And we've seen that now with a reemergence of the valuing of things like textile art and, of course, indigenous art. This kind of sense that your life can be a work of art. And there's so many ways that we can introduce an appreciation, an aesthetic sense. Even it kind of merges with a kind of spiritual sense. You know, the arts kind of take the place of that now. Not so many of us have held on to religious beliefs. And I think it's so interesting. I interviewed this anthropologist. His name is Ludovic Slimak, and his specialty is Neanderthals. So he's studied them deeply, studied all their tools. And then he said to me, actually talking about looking at us in this threshold as we consider AI, why did the Neanderthals die out? They weren't stupid. They're like, we've heard this before. They were actually very creative. In studying their tools, it's interesting. You could look at thousands of Neanderthal tools and you compare them to the tools of the Homo sapiens of that time. And they're so creative. They're like little sculptures. They kind of retain the natural forms. They're not regimented. But if you look at the sapiens, they're already kind of pre-industrial. They're all the same, the tools. So that he says that they were really artists, talking about the art of the everyday. They made their tools in a way that they could be art. And it was that generations, when faced with a newer or faster way of doing things, we can abandon the old. And that's what he says. They kind of died out because they weren't hyper-efficient like the sapiens. And now we're on this other threshold with AI becoming smarter than us, but, you know, regimented. And now it's the same story. Are we now the Neanderthals looking at what will replace us? And I just thought about appreciating the art in the everyday, and how do we make the arts, as you say, not just confined within a museum, but as you say, opening it out. Art can be any place. Within an institution, it can be outside an institution. Art can be a painting on a wall. It can be textile art. It can be the things we use. Our life can be a work of art.
Yeah, I think that in many ways, what we have been thinking about is really also wanting to invest in this space. We're doing a beautiful screening with a new film by a brilliant Thai filmmaker called Apichapong, which is called On Blue. We're going to be screening this very early in the morning, and the film is really about our kind of subconscious experience from like dusk to dawn. It will then be followed by a talk by Jameson Webster, who I mentioned earlier, who's a brilliant psychoanalyst based in New York City. I think the reason I'm bringing this up, though, is that he very much spoke to us recently about this moment sometimes between the conscious and the subconscious mind, and sometimes this moment when the subconscious mind knows something but doesn't really want to have to articulate it. It doesn't want to have to explain it. And I think that the thing that is important right now is that we're delving deeper into that, the mystery of that space. You know, I think it even came up when we had the brilliant painting exhibition curated by Alison Katz last year, and we were very much thinking about Pompeii and what had been buried and unearthing what has been buried from a psychoanalytical place. But I think that with all the things that are going to move very fast in the next 5 to 10 years, the one thing that I want to invest in, and I think hopefully the institution will be able to invest in, is this more mysterious place of the unknown and the unexplainable, and that friction between the conscious and the subconscious mind, or the mystery, that mysterious space. And I think that when we were able to sit in front of a work of art and really have an experience that feels deeply connected to us and meaningful, it is often in a place for me that isn't easily articulated. We spoke briefly about how you're an artist and you have many different facets to your practice as an artist, but also I come from a place more of making and creating than from an analytical space of historical or art criticism. So I think that we're wanting to almost double down on the things that aren't so explainable and aren't so known, and also invest more in enabling us to be in a space with artworks or having more time to read and think differently, not to sound old-fashioned.
Yes, I think that's so interesting. I'm very interested in the subconscious. I mean, anything when you talk about creativity comes about examining examining, where do dreams come from? Where do our ideas come from? I used to always be asking this question of people, and then I stopped because it depended. Some people didn't like to answer the question, but I got some great answers from some people, and I asked them about their dreams. Hilary Mantel told me all about, she used to have these kind of hallucinations and dreams, and she loved that. And so I think it's a really important question, and people tend to sometimes trivialize it, but it's really important, because finding out about our subconscious, or for where our dreams come from, what is art except for a dream made visible, a dream shared? And Neil Gaiman told me, a book is a dream you hold in your hand. So that's what it is. You're making that visible and you're sharing that experience, whether it's from an analytical, which I think it's a blend, it's creative and analytical. It's creating a space and creating events. So I think that's very much creative, but it's important. And then we have these events where we can take what was an individual vision and make it a collective dreaming. And so I love that. I wish I could come, but if anyone is in Aspen or can make it to Aspen, I think that they'll have a very interesting experience, and maybe you'll come as a viewer and leave as an artist.
That other thing that was just, Alvaro Enrique is coming this summer as well, who's a brilliant, one of the most prolific Mexican novelists of his generation. And he wrote an incredible book called Sudden Death, which starts with Anne Boleyn, also tells the incredible history of the game of tennis, but also really, and surprisingly, is about Caravaggio and Caravaggio's paintings. And so I think for us, really thinking about a novel that can bring all of those things together, really the space of hallucination and dreaming that we were talking about, and how he's very close with Adrián Villarrocas, who is also going to be doing a show with us in 2026, and it's coming this summer, to be in conversation with him. So there is a lot of overlaps between how we're working with AIR and the exhibition program and the institution as a whole.
Well, that is really exciting. So thank you, Nicola Lees and the Aspen Art Museum, for sharing your vision, curatorial philosophy, by inviting us to imagine life as no one knows it and to reimagine what artists and museums can be. I think you inspire us to consider the role of arts in society and imagine alternative futures. So thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time and vision.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Jamie Lammers. Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk, with additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions or podcasts, or submit creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.